listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, NASA recently took its Ingenuity helicopter for its first spin on Mars. We'll talk about how it's going to be used and what it means for how we explore other planets. Now, the State Department of Health Services reports that the number of vaccines given out last week went down compared to previous weeks. It's the first dip in weekly vaccination totals in about 2 months. Those numbers came after the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was put on hold because of concerns with a very rare blood clot issue. 28% of Wisconsinites have been fully vaccinated, but health officials in some parts of the state, including Appleton and La Crosse, say they've seen demand for appointments start to go down a little. And in other vaccine news, Pfizer says a booster for its shot may well be needed within the next 12 months. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and maybe your experiences. Have you been partly or fully vaccinated? How is the experience for you? Did you get a Johnson & Johnson appointment canceled last week? If you're still waiting to get a shot for one reason or another, what questions do you have? And if you are seeking a shot and having trouble finding it in a way that you can go, love to hear from you right now. What would help you get the shot you want? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. John Tempty is Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also Chair of the Wisconsin Council on Immunization Practices. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Rob. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Let's start with that small dip in our vaccination numbers here in the state last week, as many people, myself included, had appointments canceled for the Johnson & Johnson shot. Is that most of the story there for that dip in vaccine numbers?
I think it's most of the story, but not all of the story. Last week, I think we dropped about 80,000 doses across the state of Wisconsin compared to the week before. And just to put things into perspective, the week before we administered almost 420,000 doses of vaccine. So the numbers are still really, really big. But the two things to keep in mind is the pause with the J&J is done out of an abundance of caution. Our principle is to make decisions that assure that we keep everybody as safe as possible. But it should be noted that we were starting to notice some decline in interest even before the announcement for the J&J vaccine. So, for example, at the University Health Services, we noticed that there were starting to be a little bit more time needed to fill all the slots available. And then I'm hearing now from my own health system, UW Health, that we're not filling all the slots at this point in time. So we're getting to the point where the supply is, to some extent, outstripping our demand.
Is that just because supply has gone up so much, or have we gotten the people who are really interested in getting that shot and who had the best access to it? Now we're going to have to work a little harder to get to everybody else?
We're going to have to work harder to get to everybody else. But I think, first of all, a lot of people have, you know, rolled up their sleeves, come in and been vaccinated. We have had a tremendous amount of vaccine rolling out across the country, as many as over 4 million doses a day some days. So that's the good news. But we still have a ways to go as of yet to get us to the point where we're feeling real protected. And I really want to emphasize for those people out there who are at higher risk, so for example, older or with medical conditions, that it's really, really important to be vaccinated, especially now because we're starting to see people relax a little bit, you know, people congregating without masks on and so on. And this is really a risky time for those who are at risk for those bad consequences of COVID-19.
Now, age isn't the only risk factor, but that said, how are we doing in getting shots to people at those higher age groups, the people we know have had more adverse effects from getting COVID-19 itself?
Well, I think we're doing actually very, very well. And again, as you mentioned earlier, that across the state, about 41% of us have gotten at least one dose. And that's across all ages, including people who we don't even have vaccine for as of yet. So I think the good take-home message right now is if we look at the people who have received a dose of vaccine and the people who are likely to have already been infected, we're starting to get up into a majority of the state of Wisconsin. And that's really good news because what we need out there is immunity. We get immunity through vaccine, or we could have immunity less preferentially through right. becoming infected. But when we add those together, we're starting to get to the point where we might be able to really slow things down with this incredibly bad virus.
Dr. John Tempte from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health with the latest COVID-19 vaccination news. Might get into some of the variants out there as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the vaccination drive and your experiences in seeking a vaccination for yourself and loved ones. Easy? Did it take a lot of work? Did you have to drive a lot to get there? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Elliot in New Lisbon who says, I was able to find appointments in Mauston at the Walgreens. Seems like there's still a lot of openings. And Dr. Tempte, I know a lot of people have, you know, searched around online to find that shot, been willing to drive an hour or two in some cases, maybe more, to get the shot. And I wonder about the people who don't have access to the internet or a vehicle or things like that. What do we need to do to make sure people who don't have that mobility, maybe that technological access, have opportunities to get shots?
Well, what we're really waiting for is the time that we start getting more and more vaccine in our primary care clinics. That has really not happened very much as of yet. We have had vaccine flow into pharmacies. And in fact, I was on a panel last night with a community pharmacist who's immunized, I believe, over 4,000 of his patients coming into the pharmacy. But so, you know, it really does bring out the disparity in terms of access to resources, transportation, and especially that computer savviness that, you know, my children are far better than I am at doing things. And in fact, I think it was my daughter who was able to get an appointment for my wife to get vaccine. And just being more likely to have the time and, you know, the persistence to get that. So I think we really have to work hard, but I'm really looking forward to having the vaccine becoming more abundant in our clinical, our regular clinical settings.
I want to look at some of the other news out there, Dr. Tempte. We are seeing hot spots, places like Michigan seeing big jumps in cases, often fueled by the newer variants that seem to be more transmissible. I know Ontario, right next door to Michigan, countries like India. We're not at a place where the risk of that kind of outbreak is gone, right? If I express that weirdly, but I think you get what I'm saying.
I get exactly what you're saying. And no, we're not out of that risk era yet. But when I take a look at the trends in Wisconsin, we had a little bit of a fourth wave come here, and the data now are indicating that we're coming down from that. So that's good news. When I take a look at Michigan and Illinois and Minnesota, they certainly did have these peaks, but they appear like they're starting to come down now as well. But as you mentioned, across the world, there are places that are really just starting to accelerate, and India is just incredibly bad right now in terms of the cases. Also, places like Brazil are just having so many cases and outstripping their medical capacities to take care of these patients.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rosa is with us in Waterford. Rosa, hi.
Hello. Specifically the vaccine, I understand that the virus itself, the vaccine itself, it's not a vaccine in the conventional sense, where the virus is not weakened. This is actually a medicine because the mRNA, synthetic mRNA, is actually instructing your body to produce the spike proteins. Excuse me, I'm driving right now. So my question to the doctor is, how much spike protein will be developed in the body with this mRNA instructing the body to create it? That's the question I have.
Rosa, thanks for the call. So I think she's talking about the mRNA vaccine. She mentioned the Pfizer and the Moderna. Can you talk a little bit about what Rosa had to say and how this works, Dr. Tempte?
Absolutely. Well, these are indeed true vaccines. They're just using a different mechanism than we've used before. But the whole idea with a vaccine is to get in what we call an antigen, which is a chemical produced usually on the surface of a bacteria or a virus. And we want to expose our body or and basically our immune system to that typically a protein. And we can do that in a number of ways. We can provide a killed virus or a weakened virus. Sometimes we use just a part of that virus in a vaccine. So, for example, the shingles vaccine we're using now is just part of that virus. Or in the case of the mRNA vaccines, we're using the instructions, the blueprint for that protein, and providing that blueprint to our cells to make copies of that. The good news is that blueprint called RNA or ribonucleic acid does not get incorporated into our cells at all. It's used, and over the course of 1 or 2 days, it is degraded and goes away. But in the process, it makes millions or billions of copies of this spike protein that our immune system will use to respond to and produce those protective chemicals called antibodies through to ward off future infections.
Thanks for the question, Rosa. We're talking to Dr. John Tempte from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and chair of the Wisconsin Council on Immunization Practices. We're catching up on the latest vaccine numbers and news. You can call in at 800-642-1234. If you've gotten fully or partially vaccinated, how did it go for you? Was it easy to find a place to get the vaccine? Did you have to do some sleuthing and driving to get it? If you're providing vaccines yourself at your clinic, pharmacy, if you're volunteering at one of the sites around the state, love to hear what you're seeing out there. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Dr. John Tempte, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at COVID-19 vaccinations in the state and other vaccine-related news. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or your experiences seeking vaccines yourself, obtaining them, hopefully, if you're looking for them, or providing them. What are you seeing? Do you see a decline in demand? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back now to your calls. Barb is with us in Stevens Point. Barb, hi.
Hi. So my question today is, I have family and friends who are hesitant to get the COVID vaccines because they've been given emergency use approval. So I was wondering what more is needed for this vaccine to be given permanent approval. And then also, were other vaccines given emergency approval to start, i.e. like polio, did that start out as emergency approval also? And I'll take the answer offline.
Interesting questions, Barb. Thanks a lot. Dr. Tempte, what does it take to go from the current state of emergency approval to, I guess, just full-on normal approval?
That's a wonderful question, Barb. And with emergency use authorization, companies go ahead and provide information that show that the benefits greatly outweigh the risks. And it's a process used to accelerate the process. Now, the good news is that whereas the vaccines came along much, much quicker than we would have expected, they did not really scrimp at all on the safety determinations. And the reason that they were able to come along so very quickly is that for the effectiveness part of the clinical trials, they were able to accumulate data very, very quickly because they were collecting data during the time of this incredible outbreak we had in October and November. But to get to the full licensure, what a company has to do is apply for biologic licensing application or BLA. And I believe both Moderna and Pfizer have now applied for those. It's a lengthier process, but basically at this point in time, both companies have accumulated so much data on both the safety and the effectiveness of this vaccine in real-world situations, I would anticipate absolutely no problem with getting the full licensure out there. And with that licensure comes some additional things out there which are worthwhile. It comes with kind of that full endorsement. It comes with some added protections out there for recipients. And it makes people feel better about it. But the bottom line is I've had the privilege from early on, starting way back in May, being part of a work group at CDC looking at these vaccines. And as soon as I could get an appointment, I was there to get the vaccine because I've had a good understanding how incredibly safe and beneficial these vaccines are.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Samantha next in Sister Bay. Samantha, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Samantha?
So I was just listening. I'm actually on my way to get my second Pfizer shot right now. Just listening, I guess the biggest obstacle, I live in the Northern Peninsula of Door County, is getting to a vaccination spot. So it takes anywhere, you know, between 45 minutes and an hour to get to the closest places that we can do that. I work in the service industry part-time, and a lot of my friends are getting the vaccines as well. My husband and my brother actually drove 3 hours to get the Johnson & Johnson shot. It was really easy once I was able to get signed up. It did take a couple of weeks for me to find an open spot because I was looking in March when everything just opened for service industry workers. It's just getting there, I guess, is our biggest obstacle up here because it is kind of a drive and taking the time off work to do so can be kind of difficult. Workplaces have been super supportive because they obviously want us to be vaccinated.
Fantastic. Samantha, thanks. I'm glad you're on your way to get your shot now. And Dr. Tempty, there's that access issue. I know there were mobile sites that are going around. I mean, maybe those showing up in places like Sister Bay would help save a whole lot of driving for people and a whole lot of hunting.
And the response I have there is absolutely that it's beneficial, but Wisconsin's a big state, and there's a limited number of those mobile stations that are deployed. But also, I think when I was listening in before coming aboard during the news clip, there was talk, was listening to President Biden talk about, you know, providing workers the ability to get vaccinated without having any consequences in terms of their employers. And in the middle of a global pandemic, I think that's a very, very wise thing to do. We really want to get people protected. We want to have businesses not only have their employees protected, but protect their customers as well. So I'm very, very glad that Samantha is en route also glad that she's getting her second vaccine at this point in time.
And Samantha, I'm glad we can keep you company on the drive there and back for the vaccine. Thanks for calling in. Let's go next to Jim with us in Baraboo. Jim, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Hope everyone's doing well. I just want to encourage any veterans to go ahead and contact the VA. I was fortunate in that I didn't even have to search for an appointment. The VA actually called me and immediately scheduled. I got in within a week. And I've already had my second shot over a month ago, and I've had absolutely no side effects from those vaccinations. On the flip side, my sister has actually had the COVID virus twice. And even though she has had, I guess you could say, a natural immunity from having had the illness, she still went ahead and got her vaccinations. And I just want to encourage anybody that is wondering whether they should do it or not, just do whatever it takes. Go out, take care of it, get it done.
Jim, thank you so much. I'm glad the experience went well for you. I want to talk about Jim's sister, Dr. Tempty. I understand the recommendation is yes, even if you've already had COVID-19 itself, it's still worthwhile to get the vaccine. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. We do have some data from studies now coming out that show that people who have been infected and followed throughout time, still have about a 20% chance of reinfection. This is a study coming out of Denmark where they have really, really good data on the whole population. But so there's still a risk. The vaccines can help take that risk for infection down to perhaps 5% or thereabouts. So that really is a benefit. We do know, however, that people who have been previously infected may have a stronger response to the vaccine, so might become a little more achy, a little more sore arm or febrile for a few hours with that vaccine. But again, the benefits really greatly outweigh any risks out there for the vaccine. So we encourage anybody, whether they've had COVID-19 or not, to get the vaccine.
Thanks for that call. And Dr. Tempty, I like to run things by you when I see a headline and I'm not sure how big a deal it is. I've seen some anecdotal stuff that says people who have this long haul COVID, they've had COVID, they're having weird after effects from it. Some stories suggesting that the vaccine is, after they get the vaccine, they're doing better with those long haul symptoms. Have you seen anything? Do we have enough information to know if that's the real deal?
I don't think we have enough information at this point in time to make a proclamation that anybody with long haul or the long COVID should be vaccinated for a treatment. But I think there's going to be a lot of interest in the potential immunologic therapies for long haul. But you bring up an important point. I think in the wake of this pandemic, we're going to be dealing with an awful lot of hurt out there. There was just a report out yesterday that somewhere around 40,000 children in this country have lost a parent, and the long-term consequences of that are significant. These are kids who have lost a parent to COVID. Across the medical sector, the burnout of nurses and physicians taking care of patients, all the other workers in healthcare settings, and then all the delayed and deferred medical care that people have gone through over the past year. So there's so much that we have to be looking at, coming out of this pandemic that we're all going to have to work together to get out of this.
Dr. Tempty, thanks again for joining us today.
And thank you so much, Rob. Take care now.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty is Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at the latest on COVID-19 vaccinations. Coming up, helicopters on Mars. We'll look at NASA's latest big success. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Biden plans to pull all U.S. troops from Afghanistan this summer, ending the 20-year war. We'll talk with a supporter of that decision coming up. Now, here's the sound of a bunch of scientists celebrating.
And altimeter data confirms that Ingenuity has performed its first flight, the first flight of a powered aircraft on another planet.
Earlier this week, these NASA employees managed to pull off the first ever flight on another planet. The aircraft, the 4-pound solar-powered helicopter called Ingenuity, the planet Mars. Clara Moskowitz is a senior editor at Scientific American, where she covers space and physics. Clara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why fly a helicopter on Mars? Help us understand the significance of this achievement.
Well, not only is it just an amazing technical feat, it's actually really hard to do this for a lot of reasons, but it also gives you a whole other dimension to be able to study Mars. So, we've studied Mars from the surface with our rovers, and now we get to fly above in the air and scope out where we want the rovers to go, look at the terrain and the rocks and the features from a totally new angle and perspective that we've really never had before. So this is exciting stuff.
Now, all the variables we have when it comes to flight on Earth, or many of them anyway, are different on Mars. Gravity, the amount of air. Can you talk about the challenges of just making something fly in a reliable way on Mars as opposed to Earth?
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing about Mars is that it barely has an atmosphere. Its atmosphere is 99% less dense than Earth's. And that's, what we use to fly on Earth. So it's really hard to do this on Mars. And this copter had to be designed with much larger rotor blades that go much faster in order to make use of the very thin atmosphere that there is on Mars. And then you also have to imagine that there's a time delay between yeah. Earth and Mars. So we can't just use a joystick to steer this thing in real time. You have to send it all of its instructions ahead of time, because you only get the message back minutes later about what's happened there. You can't kind of direct it. So a lot of things had to go just right for this them to pull this off.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was really curious about that. I knew with the time delay, like, how could you control it in real time? So the flight, the entire flight is what, pre-programmed?
Exactly. Pre-programmed, downloaded into the helicopter as a software package ahead of time. So it, you know, it has success or it fails all on its own, and we only find out about it afterward.
That has got to be a nail biter for the team making that program, right? If something goes wrong, there's no fixing it in the process.
Exactly. I mean, and that's really the case with everything we do on Mars, with the amazing landing of the Perseverance rover that this helicopter traveled with. You know, they had to program every step of that process ahead of time and then just hope that each sequential step went as planned, because if any of them didn't, it was far too late to send alternate instructions.
What do we know about how often Ingenuity is going to fly and how long it's going to fly?
So Ingenuity is just a test mission. Its really only goal is to show that we can do this on Mars. So it will probably make up to 4 more test flights, you know, in the next month or so. And that's really all it's designed to do. But the fact that this is working so well means that you should definitely expect to see another copter on Mars in the future or on other planets in the future. This was what they call a technology demonstration, just to see if it's even worth pursuing. And it looks like it is.
Talking to Clara Moskowitz, senior editor at Scientific American, about Ingenuity, the helicopter that NASA has successfully flown on Mars. Now, Clara, it is a test flight, but it does have a camera, right? We are getting at least some images from Ingenuity.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is really exciting because it can take images of the Martian surface, of course, but it can also take images of Perseverance, which we love to see, that the rover's doing great, that it's looking good. And so it's nice that they can keep eyes on each other.
I understand this is part of a bigger mission. Ultimately, NASA is hoping to bring samples from Mars back to Earth at some point in the future. That sounds like a many-step process. What kind of things are they looking forward to be able to do that?
Exactly. So this mission is really the first step in that very exciting prospect, because everything that we've learned on Mars so far has taken place on Mars. All of the studies have been made there in situ. And what we would really love to do is get our hands on some Martian dirt and bring it back to world-class laboratories on Earth, where we can use every instrument imaginable to test these things in every possible way, you know, to touch them and feel them and see them with our eyes. It would be a huge step forward for science. But it's very hard to do, you know, so this mission is trying to collect the samples, and then it's going to be a whole other future mission that will have to go gather them from Perseverance and return them to Earth. So it's a multi-year, multi-step process, but we hope that we will be able to do this.
And we know a lot about Mars at this point, and we know that we don't know a lot about Mars at this point. With Perseverance and with Ingenuity and its hopeful descendants, the future flights on Mars, what are some of the big questions we're hoping to answer now?
Well, the ultimate question, right, is there life on Mars? We still don't know the answer to that. We've been exploring our neighbor planet, you know, for many years now, but we haven't been able to tell whether there's any living things there. And we have reason to think that there might be, because throughout Mars's past, it's been a very different planet. It's definitely had a lot of water. It's definitely had the kind of temperatures and conditions that we think life needs in the past, although it doesn't seem to be habitable right now, at least on the surface. But there's a lot we don't know. And we wonder, you know, we want to learn about the history of Mars, of Mars's water, and we want to learn about the history of Mars's habitability. And we ultimately want to know, you know, are we alone here in the universe, or could there be microbes just right next door in space?
Now, we've flown Ingenuity. I'm not taking any credit here. We humans have flown Ingenuity on Mars. Now, it seems like this is something we might be able to do on other planets or maybe moons at some point, but it seems like then it's going to be a whole new engineering challenge each time because each one is going to have its own atmosphere and gravity. Does Ingenuity point the way toward flying things elsewhere, or is that pretty far off the table right now?
It definitely does, but we're far more advanced in all areas of Martian exploration than we are with any other planets. You know, Mars is right next door, and Mars has conditions that make it easier to send vehicles to than even Venus, our other next door planet. You know, there's a lot harsher conditions in other places, but ultimately we'd like to explore farther out because Mars isn't the only planet that looks like it may have been or might even be habitable. You know, some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are very, very intriguing. And I could see a helicopter would come in very handy. But the conditions at these other places, like you said, are very, very different. So this was a baby step, an important first step. And now they're going to look at, well, now that we know it's possible, now that we know how to do it at Mars, let's look at how to do it in these other places too.
Now, getting back to Perseverance and Ingenuity, we, as you said, just a few more test flights for Ingenuity. Got to be a long time before we have more flights on Mars, then a long time before we get those samples. So for Perseverance itself, what are you most curious about? What are you excited about for what we could learn from what we have there right now in Perseverance?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so excited. This is the most powerful tool we've ever had on the Red Planet. It's got, you know, beefed up instruments, every kind of tool that we could hope for, and the latest technology. And it's traveling in a new place in Mars that we have never been. So we have a lot of potential to learn more about the geology, about the conditions there, and especially about whether there are any signs that there used to be life, whether we see any signs that microbes have made an impact on the surface of Mars. So Perseverance is going to be looking at for biosignatures, which is what we call any of those signs that we think could really only have been made by life. And it's got, you know, it's got a drill, it's got cameras, it's got microphones for recording sounds there. It's the next best thing to being able to send humans. And so I think we're going to be able to see Mars in a whole new light and really possibly get more of those tantalizing answers to the big question about whether there could be life there.
Clara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Clara Moskowitz, senior editor at Scientific American, where she covers space and physics. She joined us for a look at the successful flight of the Ingenuity helicopter on Mars. Coming up, we'll talk to an Afghanistan war veteran about his support for withdrawing U.S. troops from the country over the course of this summer. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Derek Chauvin's guilty verdict came after less than a day of deliberation by the jury. George Floyd's murder sparked worldwide protests, and for millions, his case represented more than the misuse of force. Now it's time for you to have your say. Call Jen White and 1A. You can do it now at 855-236-1212. That's 855-236-1212 with your reactions, your messages today at 6 on 1A+. Now, President Biden is getting some praise from a seemingly unlikely source, his predecessor. In response to Biden's plan to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan, former President Trump put out a statement calling the strategy, quote, a wonderful and positive thing to do. But he added Biden should do it sooner than the target date of September 11th. Trump had made a deal with the Taliban to leave Afghanistan by May 1st. Other Republicans have been critical of the move. In a tweet, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham said, quote, there's nothing wonderful or positive about allowing safe havens and sanctuary for terrorists to reemerge in Afghanistan or see Afghanistan drawn back into another civil war. Our next guest says Biden and Trump are on the right track. Sam Rogers is Coalition's Director of Concerned Veterans for America, Wisconsin, and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rob. I appreciate it.
Make the case. Why do you, having been there, why do you see it as time now for the U.S. to get out of Afghanistan?
Well, there's a few different aspects that we've approached this from over the past couple of years as part of our larger campaign to really reform foreign policy, particularly the global war on terror and the endless war in Afghanistan. We approach these things from a moral, constitutional, fiscal, and national security perspective. As you said, my my experience in the Army, my first deployment was in the 2009-2010 surge in Afghanistan under President Obama. I went again in 2012, 2013, and 2015 and 2016. And so I really experienced the second half of this conflict and seen its futility firsthand. We believe that the legitimacy of the Afghanistan government is never going to come from an American occupation and us trying to recreate some government in our own image that at some point ends up denying the Afghan people self-determination and their ability to chart their own path forward. And this is supported, you know, by the majority of the veteran community, veteran families, service members, current active duty service members, and the general public have all polled in a strong majority in opposition to continuing this conflict.
And Sam, in a recent piece, you wrote about the damage this has done to families, to people who served over there, especially in, as you said, your first deployment in the year 2010. Can you talk a little bit about the long-term impact you've seen when people return home or in cases where they don't return home?
Absolutely. You know, my unit lost over 40 soldiers, were killed, and several hundred wounded, amputees. Very serious things, along with a serious rash of suicides that started downrange, spiked when we returned, and have continued now on 10 years later. And as the military population shrinks, you know, the New York Times pointed out that almost 80% of new enlistees come from military families. Less and less of the population sees the really catastrophic impacts these things have on military families. On their communities, on their children, each really a serious butterfly effect that continues year after year. And with so few congressional representatives really interested in voting on what it is we are doing there, we just think that if we are going to sacrifice so many of our sons and daughters, our brothers and sisters, our mothers and fathers, they owe us a rigorous public debate about how Afghanistan is in our national interest and why we should continue to sacrifice people for it.
We're talking to Sam Rogers with Concerned Veterans for America, Wisconsin. He's a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, making the case that President Biden is on the right track in removing troops from Afghanistan this year. Now, the original agreement between President Trump and the Taliban had called for May 1st as the deadline. President Biden had extended that to September 11th, a symbolic date, but also, I think, recognizing some logistical challenges in getting everybody out. What do you think, though, of that delay in effect of about 5 months?
You know, obviously, we would prefer to be ending a withdrawal on May 1st rather than starting it. But to be quite honest, you know, President Biden's commitment is probably 90% aligned. We're thrilled to see, you know, president after president recognize that this is an issue that can't go on any longer. And we're thrilled that President Biden is committed to taking steps. You know, the Taliban has already said they plan to start shooting again on the 2nd of May. And it'll just be very important that folks in the public, that you know, the thousands of volunteers we've had in Wisconsin who across the political spectrum, who have reached out to the White House, who have reached out using our petition system to their representatives, that, you know, when folks start getting hurt again, and there will be fighting, that we hold fast on our commitment to withdraw troops, and we don't allow ourselves to be trapped back into this cycle of surges and withdrawals and surges and withdrawals.
I mentioned Senator Lindsey Graham earlier. He's one who's criticized both former President Trump and President Biden for setting up timelines to pull troops out. In another tweet, he said, quote, President Biden will have, in essence, canceled an insurance policy against another 9/11, end quote. And that's been the big concern, Sam, the concern that if we're not in Afghanistan, terrorist groups will regroup, not just the Taliban who work in Afghanistan, but ones that might work internationally, might target the United States. What do you say to people with that concern?
Sure. And you know, my first two tours, I was an interrogator. And then my third, I was an intelligence officer. And this is a big piece of what we do at Concerned Veterans for America is education. And this is one of those tropes that has just we've not shaken ourselves free from over the last 20 years. The idea that our occupying Afghanistan or really any developing or unstable nation where a handful or a dozen or 50 folks with ill intent could plan something terrible. The idea that somehow that has anything to do with our domestic physical security of our country is, I think, just been disproven. It's been disproven. And none of these folks who really support staying there perpetually have been able to publicly and rigorously debate and demonstrate how this has benefited our national security. You know, we're killing the grandchildren of the folks who started this. If anything demonstrates that what we're doing right now isn't working, it's that.
And Sam, you started off by saying this is a piece of a wider concern that you have about our foreign policy and the way we use military force. What kind of things would you invite people to think about when we consider when and where we send American soldiers and other service members?
Absolutely. You know, foreign policy reform is a big is going to be really the big next step after withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, particularly putting expiration dates, sunset dates into future authorizations for use of military force, you know, because the campaign in Afghanistan that started with this document that described a punitive campaign in response and retaliation for 9/11 has been expanded now to cover like over 19 countries, none of which anyone's had a say in or a vote in. In fact, you know, less than 15% of the folks who voted for the 2001 authorization for use of military force in Afghanistan are even still in the Congress. We'd like to see a regular reoccurring vote by our representatives. You know, the Congressional War Powers is one of their probably most important obligations, and they've just kind of eschewed that over the years. And we think the military needs to go back to being the absolute last resort. We believe at CVA that a strong, capable, well-trained, well-equipped military is critical to our national defense. But we also think that its place is as a last resort after all of our other educational and economic and diplomatic tools have been thoroughly exhausted. We've had a public debate about, are we willing to sacrifice our people for something?
And in just our last few moments, Sam, you talked about the impact that the service in Afghanistan had on so many people and their families. Briefly, is there something you think needs to be done for those veterans, for their families, that isn't being done right now?
Oh, man. That's a big question. Maybe I gave you just a short amount of time. Yeah, no, that's great. Listen, I would encourage folks to reach out, www.cv4a.org. or endingendlesswars.com. You can check us out, Concerned Vets for America, Wisconsin, on Facebook. We work with community nonprofits who are trying to address those things and find ways to, you know, to bottom up solve community veteran needs. And really, if any vets are struggling or if they're looking for a meaningful fight to get back into, reach out to us. And we work on VA issues as well. And It's a big field of reform needed. And Concerned Vets for America, Wisconsin will be here long term. So we'd love to have you guys on board and help you get the things you need.
We'll leave it there. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. I appreciate your time.
That's Sam Rogers, Coalition's Director for Concerned Veterans for America, Wisconsin, and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. We talked to him about his support for President Biden's decision to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan with a target date of September 11th of this year. weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, if you look at a map of COVID-19 vaccination rates, you can see big differences from place to place. Join Kate and her guest for a look at why some places are falling behind on vaccinations. That's tomorrow at 7 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we look at a push by national Democrats to overhaul policing in the wake of the Derek Chauvin conviction and round up some of the other top stories in national news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.